Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Today's show is an exploration into the story of the biblical Satan, actually multiple stories of the biblical Satan, a perspective on Lucifer, on Satan, on Beelzebub, that is not being taught in Sunday church. I mean, I've never heard anything like this from the pulpit on a Sunday morning in all my decades in church. It's a great tie-in to this week's show sponsor, by the way, The Great Courses Plus. They've got an interesting series about evil. Now, of course, Satan has long been linked with the idea of evil, especially in Christian tradition. But the course, Why Evil Exists, and its professor, Dr. Charles Matthews, explore the ideas about evil well beyond the Christian Satan narrative. The course addresses how different cultures throughout history have tried to define and measure evil. You know, what is evil? What are the properties of evil? What causes evil? From the ancient Greeks to St. Augustine to Islam to Dante to Nietzsche to Freud and beyond. Now, I use the word evil to describe an action, right? I don't have any supernatural attributes, certainly no spiritual plane or satanic boogeyman behind it. But it remains a fascinating topic. Do you believe in evil, and how do you define it? Why Evil Exists is one of over 8,000 courses that stream right to your desktop, your laptop, your TV, or smartphone from The Great Courses Plus on categories ranging from history to science to travel to music to language to hobbies and more. Right now, sign up for The Great Courses Plus. As one of my listeners, you can get this and any of the courses free for 1 month with my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. So get started now. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Now, there's video of the interview between myself and Andrea Gerichin, who's my special guest today. We actually spoke a few days ago via Skype video. So if you'd like to watch the interview, you can just click the link in the description box of this broadcast. The show is called The Devil You Don't Know. And when you hear the interview, you will understand the title. I hope you enjoy. One of the things I love about being involved in activism and in this community is the people that I run across, the people I'm introduced to. You know, a friend of a friend who knew someone who's got a great perspective. They've got an angle on something you had not heard before. Hey, you got to talk to this person. I hear these stories quite a bit. They'll send me an email. They'll drop me an IM or whatever. And my guest here on the show is just one of those people. Her name is Andrea Gerichin. And a mutual friend, David Fitzgerald, who's been on the show, said, hey, you know that at the time I was doing some research on the devil, on Lucifer, on Satan, on the biblical Beelzebub. And I thought I had a pretty good bead on it until I began to do some digging and I realized how wildly ignorant I was and how much more interesting the backstory of Satan really was. And Andrea sort of has a leg up in this field and has done some research. Andrea, thanks so much for joining me on the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Seth. It's lovely to be here.
So, do you have a dark side? I mean, what are you doing? You're researching Satan? How did this happen?
It happened basically around 12 years ago, the moment I left my faith. I prayed my way out.
No, you got to give me more on that. Wait a minute. You had a moment of crisis in your life and you didn't receive an answer to prayer and then you realized you were talking to yourself. Is that what I'm supposed to interpret out of that or what?
Pretty much. I was a worship leader, a singer-songwriter, a very full-on born-again Christian in Pentecostal movement, had been all my life. My father's a minister. From the age of two, I've been singing in church. So I was very preoccupied with that for a long time until the questions and the doubts and the contradictions were too much. And I started to peek into the Hebrew of my Old Testament Bible, which my father taught me very well. And I could not any longer justify my beliefs. And so I left my faith in a very traumatic way for me. It was a very precious thing to me, and I thought I had the truth, and then I realized that the truth wasn't synonymous with being a Christian.
And our stories have a lot of similarities, Andrea. You know, it becomes part of the DNA. You know, it becomes so deeply woven into your life, and all of a sudden you realize at a certain moment, hey, wait just a second. And then everything, I always say, instead of turning my life upside down, though, it sort of helped turn my life right side up. I hope that was the case for you.
Absolutely. It was the best thing I've ever done. But I had to understand what it was that I had been believing in. And seeing that I was raised on King James Version and mainly the Old Testament, reciting huge amounts of sort of passages for my dad and getting up in church as a, you know, a three-year-old and reciting them to church, you know, congregations. I thought I owed it to myself to just understand, well, what is this book, this Old Testament? What does it mean when it says the Lord God versus just Lord? Who are these names? What are these names that I hear about in Hebrew? Adonai, El Shaddai. I need to get to the bottom of it. So I literally prayed my way out of my faith on my knees beside my bed, and I told God that he wasn't real and that I didn't believe him anymore. And then I got up from there. I said, well, if that's the case, who the hell is Yahweh Elohim? And then I asked further questions like, well, I want to know then who this Satan character is. And by my reasoning, I felt that if the earliest revelation that Christianity claims it has is the Old Testament, then I should be able to go to that authority internally and check it to see whether what it says is actually lining up with what Christianity claims, because that was my biggest dissidence that I had. I felt that the God of the Old Testament was nothing like the God of the New Testament, the God of love, the God that is spirit. And yet I have, you know, these story after story in the Old Testament of a God being somewhere, doing something, not liking a thing and having to find out if the things he's heard are true. And it just doesn't reconcile. So that led me on my journey, and not particularly, but part of that quest, if you like, was to find out what Satan was or who he was, or, you know, just the anything about him that the Old Testament could offer.
You realize, of course, that Who the Hell is Yahweh is a fantastic title for a book. Like, if you ever write a book, Who the Hell is Yahweh is just, I thought, that's catchy. I'm not going to steal it. All right, so here I am coming out of fundamentalism, traditional Protestant Christian faith, and we hear the standard tale. God creates Lucifer. Lucifer is somehow perfect until he's not. He manifests all of these attributes where he wants to be like Yahweh. Yahweh says, sorry, there's only one of me. Screw you. Mm-hmm. He expels him from heaven. He casts him down. Lucifer's serpent enters the garden, tempts Adam and Eve. Lucifer essentially taints humankind. And then God creates hell for Lucifer, and now we want to escape Lucifer's influence, and we all want to go to heaven and escape hell. This is sort of a very rudimentary version of what we were taught regarding Lucifer. And so that was sort of the channel I was taking. That's the way I was looking at Lucifer to begin with. Hey, wait a minute. How could God create a being that was perfect that would then manifest all of these imperfections? Yeah. And as I've come to begin to understand, my understanding of that original incarnation of Lucifer is Is it wrong? Is it simply one-dimensional? Start me there. I mean, the Lucifer that was created by Yahweh in heaven. Let's start there.
Well, that is the Christian narrative. That is the Satanology of Christian theology and doctrine, what you've just sort of, you know, summarized there. The real story is nothing like that in the Old Testament. They can roll like that in the New Testament if they like. But if the claim is that the Old Testament has things to say about Satan, which you just, you know, cited, he cited Isaiah or Ezekiel about Lucifer, Isaiah, then we should be able to get some information about that. And if you want to link that to the serpent in the garden, well, there should be evidence for that in the text, and there's not. It is a mishmash of ideas that has been put together to serve a narrative that has been adopted by Christendom. So,
adopted from where? Where did we grab it from?
Look, you know, there's speculation about that. People say Zoroastrianism. So after the exile of the Jews into Babylon, exposure to that, the religion of Babylon, which is supposedly Zoroastrianism, and then they absorbed a different type of understanding of this sort of Satan evil character, and then we have sort of a monotheistic type religion then that comes into play with Judaism. But that's different from what the Tanakh or the Old Testament says. So I actually call this whole thing the Satanic Trinity, because there are really three main scriptures, if you like, in the Old Testament that Christianity hooks onto to validate its claims about the theology of Satan. So you've mentioned Lucifer. So let's see. Lucifer is in Isaiah chapter 14, starting at verse 22. Let me see. I'll actually read a couple of the verses there for you. Isaiah 14, 20. Let's see. Right. Well, basically what we're talking about, yeah, verse 12. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cast down to the ground, which just weaken the nations. Lucifer is the transliteration from the Vulgate, and it's the word Lucifer. The word in Hebrew is Halel. And, yes, it is Star of the Morning, but are we really talking about the character here of Satan? Well, up further in the text, let's see how far much up further. We're talking about in verse 4 of Isaiah 14, we're really talking about the king of Babylon. So verse 14 starts by saying that thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how hath the possessor ceased, the golden city ceased, and it goes on, and next thing you know, he's called Lucifer.
Now, were these two different characters that we're talking about?
No, this is the prophet Isaiah is coming and talking, bringing a message from Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, and he's talking about the king of Babylon, and he's literally calling the king of Babylon Halel, Star of the Morning. Obviously, it says in there that he's going up to heaven, so we need to find out what does that mean. He cast down to earth. He set his throne amongst the stars of the Elohim or God. He's in the mount of the congregation. All of these words now mean different things, and they're not really concepts that we talk about a lot in Christianity, or they talk about a lot in Christianity, but they are. Ideas and concepts that are through the Tanakh that are worth investigating to find out what it means when it says that this king of Babylon literally went up to Shemaim, to heaven.
Help me clarify then, the morning star,
yes.
Right? How do I get from the celestial character to the king of Babylon? How do I get from one to the other?
It's an interesting question. It's a good question. The Elohim, or Yahweh Elohim, is basically from Shemayim. He's from heaven. And can go to heaven, of course. In the Christian world and idea and concept, that's, of course, a thing. God comes from heaven. He visited earth. He visits earth. This king happened to do the same thing, which sounds odd, but he's not the first one to do it in the biblical text. We know that Enoch walked with Elohim, walked with God, and was not, and supposedly was taken by God. There are other circumstances where that happened. Elijah is another one that was taken up in the fiery chariot and taken off to Shemayim as well. So there are a few instances in the Bible where humans, and this is not just any human, by the way, the king of Babylon, there's a whole sort of thing we also have to understand about kings, because kingship is ordained or anointed, if you like, by an Elohim, whether it's the king of Israel, like King David, or whoever, who Yahweh is the king, is the God of that people group, Israel. But there are other people groups or other nations who have kings that are sired from other gods.
I've got Lucifer, I've got Beelzebub, I've got Satan, I've got the devil.
Okay.
Different characters?
Yes. So leave aside the king of Babylon for a minute and his name, which his title that or name that they called him, Lucifer or Halel. And let's go to the, maybe we should go to the serpent in the garden. Okay.
Now, the serpent was never presented as Lucifer or Satan himself, right? The serpent was just the serpent, but an agent of the evil one. That's how I've always heard it represented, correct?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose it depends on what type of sort of theology you're going with the Satanology in Christianity. So some people say he's a manifestation of Satan, or just, as you say, just an agent. That is right. So in Hebrew, the word for the serpent is nachash. And so this nachash was called an arun nachash, so a subtle serpent or a cunning serpent. We know that this particular one talked with Eve and beguiled her, tricked her. But really, in essence, what happened was he went up to her and said, "Hey, I know you've been told not to have of this tree over here, but you're not going to die at all." Basically saying that Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, lied. And she sort of went, "Oh, I don't know about this, you know." No, the day you eat it, God said, "You'll surely die. I'll surely die." And he says, no, the day you eat it, you'll become as gods. And so she took it, and he was right. She didn't die that day. She lived a very, very long time. And their eyes were open, and they did get to understand some more things. Some people say it's to do with sexual relations, but
let's talk about Jesus and Satan on the mountaintop, and you know, they're out there hanging out. I mean, God and Satan in some parts of the Bible seem pretty chummy. You know, they're hanging out and they're talking and doing their thing. Have you gotten into that incarnation of Satan?
It's interesting. I mean, I do Old Testament, but I obviously know my New Testament, but this character is closer to the Old Testament Satan type called Satan or Hasatan, the adversary. So that's sort of the character they're trying to, I suppose, portray that's tempting Jesus. But the interesting thing about the Satan is that most of the time in the Old Testament, when it's in Hebrew, it's just rendered as adversary. When it's not someone that's directly challenging God or Yahweh. So we've got, for example, we've got the Satan that was the angel that stopped the donkey along the road. You know, Balaam was walking, like hitting his donkey and smacking him, and the donkey wouldn't go because there was an angel there. That verse tells us that the angel called himself a Satan, a Satan. So apparently angels can be Satan. There's verses in 2 Samuel where God is actually called Satan, God himself. There's a funny contradiction between 2 Samuel chapter 24, verse 1, and The other one is in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 1. And it's where King David goes to count the children of Israel. He wants to sort of do a census. And it says in the Samuel verse that God caused him to provoke him to do the count. And that's okay. But in the Chronicles one, it says that Satan caused him to do the count. It's the same story. So which one is it?
Satan? So the idea then is Satan is not necessarily a singular character, but a type of character that might associate with several different types of people or gods.
Correct. In fact, what it is a job title. It's a job description. When you are coming up in conflict with somebody else, in the Hebrew Bible, you are called a Satan, an adversary. That is all. I mean, even the sons of God that appeared before Yahweh throne in the book of Job, which is where the key verse for Christianity is that wants to hook on to the Satan character, it says Hasatan was amongst them. In other words, the Hasatan in this verse is a son of a God coming before the very throne of Yahweh himself. And Yahweh does a deal with him, as we know. The Lord God does a deal and sort of says, you don't know this guy Job. He won't worship you if you do these things. Oh, go for it then, Satan, Hasatan. But we don't know his actual name. We only know the role he played in that circumstance. So this is what the word Satan means in Hebrew, and this is always the context that it is in the Old Testament. It is just a job description.
In the Hebrew, do you get into the fall, the casting out of a Lucifer character from heaven?
I do, and I'm in the middle of writing a book about the whole thing. It's a shocking thing that I've discovered about what the nature and the character is of this Nahash, this serpent in the garden. Don't know if we should go into it now, but it is there are clues through the Bible. I'll give you an example. Remember the story in the wilderness, the children of Israel are in the wilderness and they sin against Yahweh, and Yahweh, and the Lord God, unleashes the fiery serpents. You know that story? And they bite the people and they kill a whole heap. Yeah. And Moses there's an instructed by Yahweh to make a pole and wrap what we think it says is a serpent around it. Yeah, it's a dog's breakfast, that particular set of verses, which has sent me on a trail, which I've discovered about the nature that leads to the nature and character of the one in the garden. Basically, those things that bite, that are unleashed by God to destroy people and kill them, are called the Nachashim HaSeraphim. And you know this word seraphim? That's the seraphim.
Really?
You know, cherubim, seraphim. Yeah.
So at the end of all of this damage done, is it truly the hand of Yahweh? And the serpent is a manifestation of Yahweh's own anger, revenge, whatever? Or?
Well, yeah, I like I said, I cover this in my book. And the question is, well, what is the – if we're going to be looking at who Satan is and people and, you know, Christianity and theology wants to lump this serpent, this Nahash, in the mix as a Satan-type motif. Well, the question is, well, hang on, if he is just, if he is talking and walking and he's got all these characteristics, and I can link him to about seven other verses throughout the Tanakh where he's linked to another type of character, then I've got to ask the question, what is the nature and character of the Nahash? If he's not a Satan, what is he? What is he doing? Walking and talking in the garden? Was he created? Is he one of the animals? Is he not? It sort of says he is, but I don't think he is. He wasn't ejected like Adam and Eve were out of the garden. He was cursed, but he was remained in the garden as far as we know. The Garden of Eden, the Garden of God.
Are all of the incarnations of Satan or Lucifer scary? I mean, if you look at them, or are there any instances where Satan is kind of a good guy or a hero in some way?
Okay, so if I was to pretend that there was a Satan in the Old Testament, the Nahash isn't. He's a good guy. Sorry, I know that sounds blasphemous, but he told the truth to Adam and Eve, and let them know exactly how it was and what turned out was correct. So he seems to be at least an amoral sort of character. There's nothing beguiling or bad about him. The king of Tyre, he just was proud. The king of Babylon, same thing. So the king of Tyre is the anointed cherub that covereth, that they want, that Christianity also sort of tries to grab and make into the Satan sort of doctrine mix. He's just a, sort of like the king of Babylon, just sort of wants to be high like the Elohim and enjoy the amazing life of that you live in the Garden of Eden like an Elohim does. Then there's, what else is there? So we've got the Satan, we've got the Nahash, we've done him, Lucifer, though, so those two are the same. Satan is just an adversary. Sometimes it's God, sometimes it's a human, sometimes it's an angel. And then finally, there's one other cluster that Christians don't often talk about or call Satan by these words, the dragon, the piercing serpent, the Leviathan, and the crooked serpent. So we get those types of ideas from Revelation. And the dragon. But unfortunately, not that I go into the New Testament too much, but the verse that talks about that the dragon also brings in the piercing serpent or the crooked serpent. Now, if I look in the Old Testament for those equivalent type words that we would find in the Greek New Testament, we're looking at things like the Barecha Nahash, or the Leviathan, the Leviathan. They are found in places like Job and Psalms and Isaiah 27. But all of them, the Leviathan, the Taniim, or the crooked serpent, they're all sea creatures. And Nahash, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, is a land creature. It even says that. Even when he's cursed, he's put on the ground to slither, right? He's not put into the sea. So whatever they're talking about with the dragon and the crooked serpent and the piercing serpent and the Leviathan, that is not the Satan character that Christianity wants us to think is Satan. Does that make sense?
It's kind of a Satan salad, Andrea. You know, it's so many incarnations, so many influences, so many agendas, so many, whether it's conjured from whole cloth or whether it's borrowed from another religious tradition or otherwise, it's like the authors of the Old and New Testament are all filtering their Satan through biases and agendas left and right. And we're left with 2,000 years plus later, we're left with this huge mess we have to sort of sort through.
Yeah, that exactly. And it's taken me quite a while to sort through this. And, you know, I've obviously read different things about it. But the thing is that the Old Testament writers are consistent in their understanding that there's no Satan character as such, no classic Christian Satan character. There's no one evil agent. There is not. They pop up as little adversaries sometimes. I mean, King David is called Satan because when he goes into the Philistine territory and he wants to actually go to war with the Philistines against someone else, I think it's his own people, and the Philistines say, no, he will be a Satan, amongst us, an adversary amongst us in battle. He'll turn on us. We can't have him fight with us. So we got kings, godly kings, God himself, angels. This is not one solid person. So, yeah.
Wait a minute. I mean, Andrea, you have just dismantled the entire fundamental doctrine of contemporary Christian tradition. Without the Satan character, there is no original sin. Without original sin, there's no need to flood the earth. There's no need for Jesus on the cross. There's no need for redemption from hell. How in the world do we get from where you are, where you're looking at all of these different incarnations of a Satan, a job title of Satan, to Baptists, Assembly of God, I don't know, Catholics, do they do Satan? Yeah, they do. How do we get to the point where Satan becomes the mustache-twirling bad guy that we're supposed to rescue our children from, you know?
Yeah. It's been an evolution of this whole archetype, I suppose. So by the time it seems to me, and I'm not an expert on this area at all, but it seems to me that by the time we move into the New Testament era, the Hellenistic, Greco-Roman era, already there are ideas and theologies that bring in the one archetype of Satan, and that comes into Judaism and then, of course, flicks straight over into Christianity. And then from there we have the Roman Catholic early church fathers postulating forming doctrine and philosophy and theology about this Satan character, and they build on each other. So the earliest ones, I've got a list of them all there. I was looking through them all in my anti-Nicene Church Council fathers.
Well, I mean, I'm locked onto the New Testament, you know, the one who comes to steal and kill and destroy. You know, that version of Satan is the one who's lurking in the shadows with designs on our souls kind of thing. You know.
Wherever it came from, it didn't come from the Tanakh, from what the writers of the Tanakh meant. It came from an overlay of ideas and religious concepts that are introduced into the mix of Judaism. That's how I see it. That's how I understand it. And I think there are other scholars that think that way too. So from that point on, it just gets embellished, and the ideas get they evolve, and they become very discrete ideas about Satan until you finally get things like Dante's Inferno, where you have sort of ideas of Satan, you know, torturing people down in hell. And I mean, there are concepts of people of things, individuals being put in chains in places or kept away in other sort of Greek literature, and that's all been brought in as well. So it's sort of a
celestial version of this, of the Inquisition, yeah. Right? They find what scares you the most, and they tell you that's what hell is, and you sure don't want to go there. It's a mechanism. So many cases we see it's a mechanism for control. Fear used to control people, and I think that's pretty obvious as well.
Absolutely. I just remember when I first left my faith, I mean, within, like I said before, within minutes, I still had this horrible fear that, you know, there might have been still a Satan or something, you know, and I wanted to make sure for myself that, well, you know, I've now rejected this religion, but I want to make sure that it's still correct, that I'm right in doing that. And so that was one of the first things on my list to do. I was just going to say, too, in my studies at uni on myth in the ancient world, I read different things in antiquity from Greek literature. And over a full 300 or 400 year period, you could even see the idea of hell or Hades from being a Greek god all of a sudden becoming a place of the underworld. So from sort of moving from being a character that's just one of the many gods, which is telling and something that is evidential in the Hebrew text in another way though, to being a place where people burn and, you know, and are put when they die.
You said something interesting. I'm glad to hear you say it too, because I feel validated. When I came out of the faith, it took me over a year to shake that. What if you're wrong? You'll burn forever. The stakes are so high. I mean, you know, 30 plus years of hell theology, it'll screw a person up. And I would often hear, and I still do from people who say, I know logically that it's a bunch of crap, but I'm still, all these deep-seated fears are there. I'm terrified of hell. And my advice to them has been, you know, let's study. Go and study the origins of hell theology and get into the man-made nature of the verses in which hell is invoked. And the more you see human fingerprints on it, and the more you see how subjective and how different the incarnations of those verses are, and the more you realize it's just something that people, human beings, created, the less scary hell becomes. And it took me about 18 months, I think, if I'm going to be honest, before I finally got to the point where I walked away. How long did it take you before you were able just to shake it outright?
I went straight into study. So I straight away learned Hebrew, classical Hebrew. So within about 6 months, only because, like you say, the knowledge, the understanding of what the actual biblical text really says. I mean, even if it really said something else, you know, like the New Testament says, I still would reject it. But I got a level of sort of comfort in that there was massive contradictions between Old and New Testament. And they both can't be right.
It's like watching the different incarnations of Jesus in the New Testament, you know, and Fitzgerald gets into that, and some other people have talked about how one Jesus is different than another. They act differently, they speak differently, they lived and they die differently, and the same is true with Satan, obviously. What is your area of study these days?
Well, right now, what I did was that when I first left Christianity, I basically studied the Old Testament day and night. I found out a lot of things that I had no idea were there because I learned Hebrew and was able to read it properly. So right now I'm dedicated to finishing my book that is based on all of that research, and now I've just delved into a whole lot more. So right now I'm writing about the Elohim, and in particular Yahweh and his capabilities, let's put it that way.
Andrea, any final thoughts before I let you go? You've been very kind to sort of Skype in all the way from, which part of Australia are you in?
I'm in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales, just out of Sydney. So,
it's been a few years since I took my Australia trip, and I still have such fond memories of the Unholy Trinity Down Under tour. I'm a little sad. You know, we got to see the three cities. You know, we got to see Sydney and not Melbourne, but Melbourne. Did I say it right?
Melbourne,
And Brisbane, you know, but we didn't get a chance to go out and see any of the more exotic things. You know, we were really on the clock. We didn't really get into the outback. We didn't go to the Great Barrier Reef and any of those types of places. I have a dream of one day returning and being able to sort of take our time and go see some places that might be a little more off the beaten path. Is that recommended, or is it true that everything in Australia will kill me? You know, I don't know.
Just be careful where you step, that's all. When you come up next time, I'll take you to the Three Sisters in the Blue Mountains.
The Three Sisters in the Blue Mountains is another book title. Let me write that down. Okay, I got that. What, the Three Sisters? What's that? What would we be visiting?
You would be visiting a natural wonder of three lovely rock formations coming up out of a cliff. And they're just standalone big columns of rocks, and it's one of the most popular spots in the country.
You should work for the tourism board. You're very good at selling me on it. Well, it's something I would love to do. I'd love a chance again to see you in person. Thanks for sharing this time and the conversation. I hope will continue for our viewers and listeners. They'll continue to dig and ask questions. At the very least, we know that the very rudimentary, very basic, sort of a Crayola portrait of Satan that is being handed to us, spoon-fed to us by you know, most of the mainstream religions, at least here in the United States, are not giving us nearly the complete picture. And the more we know, the more ammunition we have in the discussions as we try to push people away from the fear of Satan and more into an interest of how it all began, right?
Correct. You're right.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Thank you, Seth. Thank you so much.
You are wonderful. You've been a great guest, and it's been a joy to talk to you. Thanks again, Andrea.
All right. See you later.
And that's the broadcast today. We may not have a show next week, as I'm coming off of the tour of several southern states and putting together shows for June. In fact, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Lawrence Krauss on the first Tuesday in June about his new book called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. But you'll want to just check the website and or the podcast page, Blog Talk Radio. And I'm going to try to get a show done for next week, but we will for sure be back Tuesday, June 6th with Dr. Lawrence Krauss for a show called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next time.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.